adult citizens outside the family, unquote. Individuals thus seek out many social goods through work.
I mean, I really think that there's only a few main factors that motivate people to do anything. There's, as you were saying, the idea of community, or there's social motivation. There's an intrinsic type of curiosity motivation that people have to regarding specific subjects. And then, of course, as I was saying in the beginning, there's necessity. Necessity isn't quite as easy as a lot of people want to make it out to be, because how much you think is necessary for you to live varies a lot based off of who you are. Now, it's pretty obvious that, you know, people need water, people need food, but how much water, how much food, how much shelter do you need to be happy, or to be you, or to feel like you have enough of what you have? Because whether or not work is necessary, or how much work is necessary for you, how much strain specifically, if we're talking again about the strain of labor is necessary for you, is dependent based off of the quality of life you want to enjoy and the factors that are holding you back from that quality of life. So it might be, for instance, that you make more than enough income to enjoy whatever quality of life you'd like to enjoy, but that you're also but you also have a very large amount of debt. So in that case, the motivation for work, or the strain or struggle of work, is tied not with the work itself or with necessity, but instead with an external factor, which is debt. So it's that type of situation that makes you wonder about, well, what debts are just and what debts are unjust. And that's, of course, a very big societal question in terms of how much of a right do citizens have to ask things from other people, or how much is it right for one person to ask of another person? I remember when I was writing a paper on this, the ancient Athenian merchant Solon, who basically more or less invents the democratic constitution for the city of Athens, did so on the basis of abolishing the practice of selling someone into slavery to service their debts. So for ancient Athens, democracy was literally created to prevent citizens turning each other into slaves for the sake of debt. So that seems like quite a sad thing to say, but at the same time, I think it's really important to think about that what a society does is it grants certain individuals the rights and opportunities to engage with that society. And it offers those in a lot of different ways. And that's, you know, a really big, complicated thing, which is why this discussion is so hard. We don't want to get to a point where work becomes not only necessary, but so much more than necessary that it becomes a matter of basic survival rather than a matter of improving one's quality of life. Those are two very different states of being and mindsets and existence.
Would increased perception of influence or value in the workplace as an individual translate to increased perception of influence in the civic sphere? So put more concretely, let's say you're given the chance to vote on a policy in your workplace and you see the effects of that. Would that make you more likely to, say, vote in the next election? And I think this speaks to what you are talking about, Aaron, about the workplace and what it does for people and what keeps them invested in it. I think you tend to have a pretty cynical view of work, from what I can tell. You seem to be quite on the side of oppressive, you know, hierarchical structure. You do seem to have this stance that, like, work is fulfilling a lot of people's necessities, and it's a way for people to deal with their struggles. And I don't think you would deny that there's work that people enjoy. Maybe you would say that's because they're in a better position otherwise to be able to enjoy that work because they're not using it to supplement parts of their life that are lacking, their quality of life. I want to talk about that investment because I think that that also is talking about value and what value people derive from work. If you get that increased investment, if you get the chance to feel as if the workplace is, you have as much say and you're as much of an important part of your workplace as you are in other spheres in your life, does that change the value of work to you? And do you think that spills over into other aspects of life?
Do the interactions that we have in a small group, do they lead us to prefer those actions in larger group settings? If I'm given choice in my workplace, do I want to, and that's very beneficial for me, do I then want choice in the public sphere as well? It's an interesting question. It's a question that I puzzled over a lot in university as I was thinking about like what makes a functional society, as one does when studying world history. The one thing that I came to think about was time dynamics. And I know that this is beyond the scope of this episode, but I feel like it's still worth getting into. So what any system that governs a group of people has to respond to the people's needs in a reasonable amount of time. If it's unable to do that, the system itself will collapse because the people will stop using it. Democracy, fundamentally speaking, takes the longest because it involves the most people. An autocratic system, since it's run by one person, as long as they appoint the right people in the right places, it's the most efficient you could think of. An oligarchical system would also, in theory, be more efficient than a democratic system because you're involving less people in a decision-making process. The reason I bring this up is because a democratic society by nature can't deal with everyone's problems. You can imagine, for instance, that a judge is able to solve the problems of everyone in their community. But if everyone in the community had to sit in an assembly to judge everyone's problems, there would be no end to it. A governing mechanism only has so much capacity. So the types of issues that can be considered democratically are different than those that can be considered by one individual or by a few individuals. What I should have mentioned is that essentially I'm not talking about autocratic or dictatorial governments in this context. What I'm really talking about is you have a system where one person is making decisions, you have a system where a few people are making decisions, and then you have a system where most of the people are making decisions. So you can organize that in a whole bunch of different ways. But to answer Mihai's actual question, which was, do you get an increase in civic engagement? I think it fundamentally comes back to socioeconomic status. So if someone is able to gain something that is personally and materially meaningful to them through civic engagement in the smaller sphere of a few people, then they'll probably try to do that in a larger group of people. And I don't think those ideas are as disconnected as a lot of people like to pretend they are. A lot of people want to say like you can be intrinsically motivated or extrinsically motivated. I think for a lot of people, it basically is both. They want to be intrinsically motivated towards something, but they also have to be realistic and expect some amount of external accommodation or incentive. Otherwise, it won't be worth their time. It won't be possible or sustainable for them in the future. So creating a sustainable society is, I think, the main problem that's answered by work, is a society that can sustain itself so that it doesn't have to live, you know, every day as a matter of survival. Instead, it's every day it's every day is like every other day. It's not a question of, oh, well, you know, there's no more buffalo in the river, so we're not going to have any food tonight, or there's no more fish in the river, or there's no more crops in the ground. Essentially, what technology does throughout the progress of human civilization is allowing human beings to create more and more sustainable control or influence over their environment. And that is what you will see, I think, with individuals going into society and choosing to vote, is you'll see them trying to exert control over social groups the same way they've tried to exert control in their own lives. Because that's usually what people do, because it's the only experience they have. Of course, there are exceptions to that, but I think that would generally be true.
Interesting. So in the interest of time, I won't dive into all of that, but that does give us some good material for a future episode. I do want to turn it for the last little bit here to the future of work as another great segue there. Again, there are other elements that we can touch on here. First of all, to that particular question, there are some other answers possible. For example, is it more likely to be the other way around, that if a society, if a civic culture is more conducive to giving people perception of influence, that they'll take that into their smaller spheres, or so on. So there's other ways to answer that question. There's also some opposition to the traditional sort of setup of work as we have it now that the author of this particular article mentions, things about like internal tension between, like you said, your job feels meaningful to you, but it doesn't pay enough. And that's a tension that, like, you don't get the resources that you need, but it is work that you want to be doing. So, or maybe you're talking about things like unrecognized costs. So things like taking time away from other things that are not work related, or, you know, self-commodification, alienation, all subjects like that we can get into. But I do want to turn it to the future of work for the last little bit here, and talk a little bit about, for example, technology and what it's doing. And another question that came up in class that, you know, we've talked about briefly a bit before, but I think will be good in context, is something like, should technology, in this case maybe artificial intelligence is a good specific example, take the boring jobs, or what we might say the interesting or creative jobs, or will it take the boring jobs or the interesting jobs? I think, of course, we've talked on the show a little bit about things like AI that can create art, music, all of these other things. We, I think, had this conception that technology is meant to take the jobs that no one wants to do and make it more efficient so that we have time for other things. And I think that people still have that vision in mind, but now we're seeing that technology has the capacity to do so much more than we ever thought it could. So I want to turn that to you, and I want to talk a little bit about, where do you see future of work and tech? Where would you counsel caution? I would say, for example, I have maybe an interesting take that I don't know quite that I believe it 100%, but I think it'd be interesting to throw at you, which is, does it matter if you go out into the world and you don't know whether what you're consuming, that's, let's say, artistic in nature, is AI generated or human generated? If art can look so close to a human painting, or if a piece of music can be just like a human would make it, and you don't know whether the thing that created it is a robot or a human, does that make a difference to you? I think we might say inherently we might choose human music over robot music because it has some kind of element of humanity. It has something relatable. It's something, it almost seems like blasphemy to pick something non-human over something human. But if you don't know the difference and it's indistinguishable, what does it matter? I'm not sure that it does, but that might be a hot take. So anyway, I've dropped a number of ideas there. Feel free to jump in on whatever of those points you found most interesting.
I'm reminded, of course, of the Star Trek episode from The Next Generation called The Measure of the Man, which asks the question of what is sentience? So you might say, well, what does that have to do with, you know, appreciating AI-generated art? Well, fundamentally, the question becomes, is artificial intelligence capable of everything a human being is capable of? Most people would say that sentient machines today do not exist. But if at some point in the future, and of course there's a lot of science fiction about this, of course you can read the wonderful works of Isaac Asimov if you don't believe me, and his ideas of robots. So yeah, these ideas have been around for a really long time. But the question of sentience is essentially, I think, what is at issue here? Because if human beings uniquely possess sentience, and technology will never be able to achieve that, then technology will never be capable of understanding art and beauty and truth and the subjective, beautiful, societal things that we have as human beings. If machines are capable of sentience, then that changes the whole question. Now, most people don't want to take this issue that far. They want to dance around it and go back to the nice question of, you know, can I get a robot that will make me a cup of tea perfectly in the morning, precisely when I want it, and bring it to me in bed, because I don't want to get out of bed this morning. And that type of question is pretty easy to answer. It's physically possible, so it's possible for a machine to do that. Whether or not that will ever be practical, that's up to the engineers to solve.
I want to focus a little bit more, if you will, on what does that actually mean for us as workers? I understand that, you know, we're talking about the sentience question and maybe the value of the product, which I did ask about. But more so, I'm interested in what does that mean for us as workers if, not necessarily if we get replaced, which I think we've talked about a bit before. We've also seen with the Industrial Revolution, we thought we'd be replaced by the plow. It turns out we're working today more than ever. So, you know, there's a discussion to be had there. But as workers, what does that mean for the workplace, for our perception of work, if there is technology that can take jobs that we see right now as having that creative critical element or being indispensably human? But anyway, yeah, I want to pass it to Brandon here.
Yeah, I think when this discussion comes up, the concern is this idea of, well, the AI can be, or whatever technology that we're talking about, it can be creative for us, or digital technologies have emerged and they have not rendered creativity from the artist. They still require a human to get things going, but having, you know, digital tools doesn't, first of all, it doesn't actually stop traditional artists from doing what they do. They can still pick up pencils and brushes. But also it enables people to just do more of that in a different way. People can be creative again. So the concern becomes, well, is being creative work? When I pay an artist to produce a work of art, am I paying them for this thing that they can do that supposedly other people can't do, which is be creative and produce something, be the sort of initiating principle in a way? And interestingly, I think that, well, like, yes, you can do that. You can even do that for great works of art. You can commission artists to make masterpieces that kind of go above what we might today just kind of deride as mere content. You can have people who just make content. Sure, AI can produce content. It might even produce beautiful works of art. That's not outside of the realm of possibility. You can't really guard against that. Just might end up doing that. But I think the thing to note with this, and when people use AI, that's the thing we have to realize, is that when an AI does it and they are creative and they do the thing that the artist is paid to do, and now there is this worry of, okay, well, artists are obsolete because we have automated creativity. The thing about that is that a person has to do that. They might end up becoming autonomous. They might do all sorts of things in the realm of sci-fi. Again, those are within possibilities, but, and maybe this kind of, it puts an expiration date on my discourse, but right now it doesn't seem like, or right now when someone wants a piece of art from, you know, a generative AI or something like that, it's a person that wants it. It has to be prompted in a particular way. They have some project or goal in mind. So the question becomes, well, where is the principle of creativity there? And again, this kind of become, this goes back to this idea of like, well, it's just a tool for this or that. I don't think it is just a tool. And I hope my, what I'm saying isn't reduced to that. I hope what I'm saying is a bit more insightful. And it's the question of, okay, well, if what we're worried about is that principle of creative initiation, what we have right now doesn't take that away just yet. It might, again, like, again, things can change. But now, when we're talking about workers, what that will do, I predict, I foresee, I prophesize, is that, and it, you see this already happening, I think, it will change what people are doing for work. Because if this becomes a tool, now your job is no longer to pick up a pencil or pick up a tablet. It's now to prompt these machines. You become the artist by prompting and whatnot. And that's kind of what we have seen with AI artists and whatnot. They are that principle of creativity. You know, they push the domino, so to speak. And in that way, we are in a kind of, well, it's just a tool situation. It's led to what people have termed a democratization of it. Maybe, but that word is a bit, I would say a bit loaded. I would want to think about that more, and we're running out of time. So this is what I have to say, and I hope it answers the question.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. I think there's some interesting insights there that basically what, to draw on one specific point about what you said, what I heard is that as you see it, this, like other technological developments, won't eliminate work but change it, which I think is an idea that many people have come to when discussing this kind of thing. And I think it's quite a good position to take. It seems quite well-founded. I want to end on one last question here that I thought was personally quite interesting, and I'll answer it too. So maybe we could take 2 minutes apiece to talk about this. And I'll start with you, Brandon. Let's say we are now in a post-work society. So whatever you want, let's say universal basic income, so you can achieve, you know, you have your necessities, you can live, you are no longer required to work for money. So would you, in a post-work society, still want to work? Given everything we've talked about, however you want to frame that concept of working in your mind, would you want to work in this utopic society where it's no longer necessary?
I'm going to do the typical philosophical thing where I kind of answer it by not giving I think I'll answer it, but I'm going to give it a kind of prefatory answer, which is that we'd have to bear in mind that if that were the case, if I'm trying to answer this question, I'm answering it with my current conception of work. And I have no idea what work would look like in this kind of post-work world.
Sure. Let's say now, you're someone gives you cash every month. You can afford your place. You can afford your food. And everyone is in the same boat. Would you go to work?
I mean, I think I would, because the things that I would do for fun and leisure kind of coincide with what some people do for work. I don't know if I would be doing work as work, but I would be doing something that would be considered work or would be practiced as work. You know, it would be a lot of fun to get into something like bookbinding or something like that.
What is going to fill the void of no more work in my life? For me, that would be very, very, very easy. I would fulfill my childhood dream of becoming a scholar, and I would read books and talk to people all day and maybe write a few books. Like, it's versus like, well, what do I do at work anyway at this point? I just talk to people anyway and solve their problems and go to their houses and work for them. So realistically speaking, to me, work is more or less what you make of it. I think for a lot of people, there's this always this question of like, well, you know, adults work, children play. And so once I grow up, I have to work. And if I don't work, I'm not an adult. I'm not a functioning member of society. I'm not a contributing member of society. And so there's that. I think honestly that that's just really toxic. Because I think you can be a person who is, you know, contributing to your family, contributing to your community, but not technically be working. And you can still be considered a good person, philosophically speaking, and culturally speaking, societally speaking. Like, just because you don't fit whatever box it is.
And that question of work that's not paid, work that's not recognized as work, homework, caring for people. If there's any job that really is, I think, work, that people consider work, that isn't always recognized in the way it should be, maybe, I think I would end up becoming a teacher. Another job that I think is essential is passing on that knowledge to new generations, right? Of everything that we do and everything that we contribute. You've been listening to The Canadian Philosophy Show. My name is Mihai Kovacevic, here behind the mic once again with my hosts Brandon Brownlee and Aaron Wang. Thank you all for joining us and for listening. Tune in to tcps.podbean.com to find this episode and others. And we can't wait to see you in the next one. Good night, everyone.
You can find archived recordings of The Canadian Philosophy Show on mixcloud.com/TheCanadianPhilosophyShow and tcps.podbean.com.
Music and podcasts from CGSF 90.1 FM with our radio app. It's on-the-go listening made easy. You can tune into all our music, spoken word, and multicultural shows using your device. Our app lets you set reminders so you'll never miss your favorite show again. stay connected to CGSF 90.1 FM through our community radio app. Download the app from the Apple Store or get it on Google Play.